entering part two of We the People today. We are here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. And I don't think you can successfully decide whether it's a compatible or incompatible viewpoint until you find out about the guy who started the religion.
Right.
So that's kind of what we're about today. So
once you read this, I think you'll realize that some of the things that he did, had he done them in modern times, there would be no doubt he would be a war criminal.
Well, he is doing them in modern times, but people are pretending that that just started.
Right.
It didn't just start. It started way back in the 7th century. So without further ado, hit it, Frank.
All right. Okay. Yeah, it all started 1,400 years ago. It's all about Muhammad. There's no way around it. And it's never going to be different. This could last another 2,000, 10,000 years and won't be any different, except I would hate to see what the world is like in the future if it continues. All right, so here we are. This is the last major battle with the Meccans. They basically left. This big windstorm started up and toppled all their tents, and it was in the middle of the night, and it was freezing rain, and, you know, Muhammad had succeeded in sowing mistrust between everybody, using very deceptive tactics. It was brilliant in its own way, but Machiavellian and dirty and, you know, very political. So they left. And when they left the Kanuka Jews, I mean the Kureza Jews, exposed, because they had, in fact, sided with the Meccans. So Muhammad then laid siege to their fortress, and it lasted for 3 weeks. Now, they finally gave up, and they asked for the same terms that were given to the Nadirs and the Kanuka Jews, but Muhammad refused. And instead, he had all the males beheaded, 900 men and boys. It could be 700, probably 700 is the accurate number, but what happened is that after they gave up, all the men were rounded up and marched across the valley to the Muhammad's territory, where his mosque was. All the women and children were enslaved, and they were taken to the same area. Then Muhammad had a trench dug in the marketplace not far from his Al-Qaeda mosque, where he beheaded all of these men and boys. If they were adolescents, they were beheaded. And some of them, you know, they would take their clothes off because they had pubic hair, off with their heads, you know. So he beheaded all those people, and he presided over most of it, if not all of it.
And how many was there?
700 or 800 or 900. But probably 700 is the accurate figure. So this was a major undertaking. Two of his first cousins, Ali, whom the Iranians worship as the founder of their Shia version of Islam, and another first cousin, Zubair, according to the literature, did the beheadings. And they would take these men out, five at a time, and kneel them in front of this trench, and then cut their heads off, and then throw the torso into the pit. Now, if you do some quick math here, and you can see that it took a long time. If it took, on the average, 1 minute to kill each one of these people, if it was 900 men and boys, that would be 15 hours of beheadings.
Wow.
Probably went a little quicker than that. But it lasted until late in the night, from the afternoon until late in the night under torchlight. Imagine the horror of it. You put yourself in the situation of these people. They're being marched out five at a time, pushed to their knees, told to bend their heads forward, and then these two Muhammad goons cut their heads off.
Hmm.
It's horrific. So this is one of the major atrocities that he committed, hardly the only one, but it was one of the major ones. And it's in their own literature. And, of course, they'll rationalize it, saying that, you know, they they offended God and his messenger, basically, by siding with the enemies of God, the Meccans. So they deserved their fate. Now, their fate was actually dictated probably more by Muhammad's greed and his need for booty than anything else, because he needed to pay off his people. They had just undergone this tremendous siege from the Meccans. They were exhausted, and he needed to keep them happy. So, you know, he confiscated all the property, and this property he distributed. Also, he distributed the slaves. So there were about 1,000 women and children that he enslaved. He divided them into 5 different lots of 200 each. He kept 200, which was his share. 2 of his followers from Mecca were really wealthy and were able to purchase 2 of the lots of 200 each. And, you know, they traded and bartered and made some good money reselling all of these slaves. The last 400, he took under armed guard north to Syria, where they were sold into slavery. And then the money was brought back and distributed. Actually, they bought horses and weapons with all that money and then brought the horses and weapons back. But then they resold the horses and the weapons in order to raise cash so they could distribute the money to all of the participants, right? That's how it worked.
Sure.
So this is one of the most sordid episodes of this holy man. Then this is when afterwards, now this is when they actually made the pilgrimage to Mecca and thumbed his nose at the Meccans, because he realized after that defeat, you know, when they left and abandoned their siege, that they were finished. They weren't going to ever do that again. So he was on firm ground when he went down there on pilgrimage and taunted them, and then ended up with the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. So, you know, then he came back to Mecca with his men. He didn't actually get to Mecca to make the pilgrimage. I mean, part of the agreement at that time was that he would not be able to come in that year, but the next year. So, in the meantime, he went back to Mecca, then he organized this attack on Khaybar, because he felt that the real threat now was coming from the north, and he wanted to neutralize it. So he attacked Khaybar, and he took it one fortress at a time. It was difficult at first, but in one of the fortresses they found some siege weapons, catapults and battering rams, covered battering rams and stuff like that, that he used then to defeat the remaining fortresses. The Jews, the last of the valley, basically decided to give up. And these happened to be the Nadirs, the same ones that Muhammad had chased out of Medina, you know, a couple years before then, 2 or 3 years before then. And they talked Muhammad into letting them leave. But one of the Nadir leaders who had previously been in Medina hid the tribal treasures, gold goblets, silver goblets, jewels, whatever. And Muhammad got wind of it, and he brought the Jewish leader before him and demanded to know where all of these treasures were. And the man said that they didn't have them, that they sold them all in order to raise money for their defense. And Muhammad said, well, you know, if you're lying, I'm going to have to kill you. So he found actually that these treasures were uncovered. And so he learned that the treasures had actually been buried. And the Jewish leader denied it, but then Muhammad had him tortured. He was pinned or chained to the ground. A fire was started on his chest. And he was tortured like that in order to reveal where the treasures had been buried. But he didn't reveal where they were buried. And he was taken out after being tortured and refusing to divulge anything. He was taken to one of the palm groves and beheaded. And the same fate happened to one of his brothers. And probably all of the nobles of that particular tribe were slaughtered too. Then Muhammad took the wife of that Jewish leader as his wife. He had all the women brought before him to check them out. This is what he did with the Qurayza Jews too in Medina, after the fortress of the Qurayza Jews fell and the Qurayzas gave up. He had all the women paraded in front of him, and he took the prettiest one, Rehana, back then, as his wife. Well, he did the same thing here in Kaibar, where he got wind of the fact that the wife of this Jewish leader was really beautiful. So he had her brought before him. He liked her beauty, and then took her as his wife. That sounds like modern politics, doesn't it?
Yeah.
In
its own way. But anyway, he added her, this Jewish captive, to his harem, which was growing by then.
Of course it was. Hang on one second, Frank, so we don't wind up with all our breaks at the in the last 15 minutes.
Alrighty.
Which usually happens. Take a really quick break. We're here with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad, a biography of the world's most notorious prophet. We're on We the People. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad. But don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
We won't. We're going to tell everybody about you.
Yeah. No misunderstandings.
Yeah, no misunderstandings. All right, so what else was Muhammad up to?
Oh, what else? Well, he was very busy killing people. Yeah, anybody who resisted him, you know, watch out. So, anyway, after Kaibar, you know, he takes the Jewish wife, the wife of his victim as his wife. He ends up with 13 wives officially, but he had actually tried to add about 20 more. I don't know where he got the time to do all of this.
I was going to say, that's a lot of wives.
Grand verses, mass murder people, acquire, 13 wives and attempt to get 20 more. I don't know if he ever slept. Anyway, there's a lot to this, and it's just impossible to cover it all, but just to fast forward a little bit, after making his trip to Mecca, the pilgrimage that was aborted. He did go back to the following year, and he made the pilgrimage, actually entered into Mecca. The Meccans allowed him safe entry for 3 days and 3 days only. And they did the routines of, of orbiting the Kaaba at that point, doing some of the other ceremonies of the minor pilgrimage, it's called. But he also was starting to rebrand the rites of the pilgrimage at that time. The pilgrimage dated way, way back, and the Meccan part of it started whenever it was that they found a meteorite there next to the riverbed, which was probably like 400 years before Muhammad's time. But it's a long-standing tradition of pilgrimage throughout the Levant. Even, the Jews went on pilgrimages, everybody went on pilgrimages. So he rebranded the Temple of Mecca. He already started that years earlier after he broke with the Jews. He began claiming, and he put into the Quran a lot of verses about this, where he moved the Abraham story from the Levant to Mecca, where, Abraham took Ishmael, not Isaac, but Ishmael, to Mecca after Hagar and Ishmael got the boot from Abraham and Sarah. Sarah was jealous and so forth. There's a long story there. But in the Bible, of course, they remained pretty close to Jerusalem. But in Muhammad's version, he moved them down into Mecca, where they built the Kaaba. It had originally been built by Adam, but then was destroyed in the Great Flood. But Abraham and Isaac, and Ishmael, rebuilt it, okay? and so we're talking like 2,500 years before even Muhammad, right? But in fact, we know from historical records and from the evidence of archaeology that it could not have dated, the temple could not have dated back more than 400 years. And even at the time when Muhammad was born, up until he was 35 years old, it didn't even have a roof. So it wasn't even known as the Kaaba before that, because it was just a rectangular wall without a roof. So how could it be called a cube? Cube is Kaaba. Kaaba is like a nickname, right? So anyway, this rebranding began at that point, where he moved the story to Mecca. He was a genius. You know, you got to give him credit. This guy was a fabulous creative genius, where he took all these different elements and then regurgitated them in a way and reshaped them in a way where he became the hero of the story.
Yeah, he took the facts and kind of spun them. There was just enough truth in it to spin his own story around it, and people bought into it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they were ignorant. How did they know any different?
Sure. Most of them never read. You know, it was all word of mouth. So it must be true if Muhammad
said it. The Jews had their story. He said it was false. You know, how are they going to dispute what he says? He distorts, changes everything, claims that they're making things up and that they corrupted the truth that God had given to them. You know, and so he imposed his myth about himself and these myths that he created about Abraham and Ishmael. And it didn't stop there, you know. There was a year later, you know, he conquered Mecca using another ruse where he allowed himself to invade. And this time he was the one that had 12,000 men. And they invaded. The Meccans decided not to resist. They gave up. Muhammad gave them all a month to convert or die. So, of course, they converted. Then the leadership he bought off by giving them a lot of privileges. And in subsequent battles, when he attacked the Taif region, which is to the east of Mecca, there were some major tribes there. Then, he gave the Meccans all kinds of goodies, including slave girls. So to buy them off, to make it sweet for them, make it to encourage them to become good Muslims. So, this process took place over the next few years after, the attack on Khaibar. So, and all this time he's reinventing this whole story about Mecca and the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage, the old pilgrimage, there used to be two pilgrimages. I don't think most people are aware of this, and probably most scholars, given the literature that I've read, they seem to be totally ignorant about this, but it's all there in the books, in the original literature. I mean, you have to read between the lines in a lot of this, but there were two separate pilgrimages. One was the sun pilgrimage, where they worship the sun, and the pilgrimage would begin at the Mount Arafat, which is about 15 miles east of Mecca. And they would stand on the Mount of Arafat, just like they do today, and watch the sun decline. Then they would race west towards Mecca, on foot or on camel. It was a couple hours away to a place called Muzdalifa, which is another mount. And then they would wait for the sun to rise. And they would break out in celebration when they saw the sun again. You know, the sun was a mystery back then. It's still a mystery. But, back then they had no idea whatsoever about the nature of the sun, only that it was there, it gave warmth, and that because of the sun, things grew. So it was natural to worship the sun. And that was how they do it. They did it on their pilgrimage. And then it would end up a little bit closer to Mecca near Mina, Ad Mina, where they had the sacrifice of the animals. And that would mark the end of the pilgrimage and also the shaving of the head. But they also, there was a second moon worship pilgrimage, which was centered in Mecca at the temple there, the Kaaba, which later became the Kaaba. But that is, the temple was devoted to moon worship. Even though they had all quite a vast array of different idols and whatnot, and God concepts that they worshiped, central to the temple was the worship of the moon. And that included the traditional orbiting of the temple seven times by the pilgrims. They would go in, you know, counterclockwise motion. And then there were these two mounts next to it, Safa and Marwa, which were all part of the ritual too. So Muhammad, you know, was always in the process of rebranding this. This running between the two mounts, which they still do today, he attributed it to Hagar. Hagar, after Abraham dumped them in the valley and then left to fend for themselves, you know, they were running low on food and water, and Hagar was really freaking out, and she was running back and forth between the mounts looking for water so that Ishmael would not die. And then an angel interceded, I think, and hit the ground with its foot, and suddenly water sprung out of the ground. But this running between the two mounts, it had a history going back, you know, however, hundreds of years, totally unrelated, but Muhammad created this myth, this story about it. It's kind of a funny story, you know, she's running back and forth looking for water. This is why they still do that today. That's part of the ritual of the pilgrimage, based upon the myth that Muhammad created about all of this. But he also rebranded the other part, the sun worship, where the Mount Arafat ceremony part of it was where the Muslims are supposed to gather in worship, just like, and he claimed Abraham did too. But it was like in anticipation of the afterlife, prior to the Day of Judgment, they would all assemble, waiting for their judgment before God. And so that's what Arafat symbolizes now. And then the trip to Muzdalifa and all of these things, they've been all rebranded in that way to where it had an Abraham angle to it. So it's totally invented. I mean, totally, totally, totally invented, but presented as the truth. And since it's been out there for 1,400 years, people take it to be the truth, even though it's a pure invention. So this is what Muhammad created, the mythology about Abraham and his connection to Abraham. He was a descendant of Abraham, and God commissioned him to bring the truth back that everybody else had rejected. And the truth is in the Quran. The Quran is God's word. Follow it, and you've got a clear path to heaven. So, paradise. This is what his message was. So, you know, it's pure baloney. It's hard to see through it, though. You know, it's really hard to see through it, and you have to do a lot of studying to be able to penetrate all this nonsense. But once you see it for what it is, it really becomes clear and obvious. So that's what I try in my book. I mean, it all leads somewhere. Another important myth about himself was that he is the intercessor with God. He will be the intercessor with God for all of his believers in the afterlife, after, you know, the resurrection. These are ideas that he took from Christianity and Judaism and refashioned them. He will be there like an advisor to God to help assist him in determining who should be rescued from hell if it happens that they ended up in hell, or to prevent them even from going to hell. He would make recommendations to Allah. It's called the intercession. He's going to intercede for people. So this is the role that he assigned himself. It's a great myth, you know. He created this fabulous myth about himself this way, where he's going to be God's right-hand man on the Day of Judgment in determining the fate of mankind.
Imagine his surprise.
It's called grandiosity in psychological terms. Narcissistic grandiosity, whatever. It's probably a couple hundred words you could apply to that guy. But it was brilliant. I mean, you have to really give him credit. This guy was totally brilliant.
How many people who actually follow this, and I know you can't give a number, but I mean, do you think most people know this history? Because I'm kind of assuming a lot of them don't.
I don't think so. I don't think many Muslims know anything. You know, it's... how many Christians read the Bible?
Well, I guess that's kind of what I was going for.
They're raised Christian, they're raised Catholic or whatever, and then they believe because that's what they've been taught.
Sure.
But they never go into it in any depth. They go through all the motions, the rituals, which is okay, I guess. I mean, there's good socializing function there of religion, and they, you know, participate in that. And then they learn, you know, some ethical ideas that serve them well in life. The Christians, not the Muslims.
The creepy part of this story is it's like reading Jesus in reverse.
Is what again?
It's like reading about Jesus in reverse.
Oh, yeah. Muhammad, Jesus is total light, you know. Muhammad is darkness.
It's all about get rid of your stuff, follow me, turn the other cheek. This guy's about get more stuff, chop off their heads. I mean, it's like really different messages.
Bow down to my God concept or I'm going to kill you.
That's right. And all your friends, too, and... Do you have anybody who's 6 or older? Because I really like him young. I mean,
yeah, he set the pattern, too. I think he was, you know, really out of line even back then. One of his early wives was a little girl, Aisha. I think people are hearing more and more about Aisha now.
I think they are, too.
She was like 6 years old when he was betrothed to her. She was the daughter of Abu Bakr, who was one of Muhammad's important followers, who later became the first caliph of Islam. And then he married her just after getting to Yathrib, right after the construction of the mosque. The girl was brought to her, and in the wording of the literature, the marriage was consummated. So, and she was 9 years old. So she was with him, you know, for the rest of his life. I think she was 18 when he died. So 9 years with him. She's a big source of information about him. About 2,200 of the stories, the anecdotes, you know, the traditions about him come from her. So she's been an important source. But she was like one of 13 official wives, and she was really disruptive. I mean, she was just a little girl, and then all these different women started coming in and competing for Muhammad's attention. So she became really jealous and very disruptive.
Well, yeah, she was, what, first grade when she was married to him? Yikes. Okay, we need to take a quick break. I got to go, I don't know, wash my mouth out with soap or something. Ew. Muhammad, what are we going to do with you? We're here with our guest, Frank Burley, discussing his book. It's all about Muhammad, and seriously, a book worth reading. It's a real page-turner. He's written it... you know, it isn't just like on this day this happened. It isn't the history you remember from school. Very entertaining. Oh, you're going to love this song, too. Bob, you're a bad man. We'll be right back.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try.
Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, destruction.
A little destruction here and there. A little terrorism. What the heck? It's a little terror between friends, especially if you're, you know, forming a major religion.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to use the available tools that actually work.
That's right. If you have young daughters, there's a place for them, too.
Exactly. Everybody fits in.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, if he had to rely on persuasion, he would not have gotten anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
It just wasn't working. In Mecca, he only converted 100 or 150 at the most. And that was, you know, through, you know, arguing his case, you know, with them. He didn't really begin to accelerate and gain a lot of converts until people were afraid of him and afraid of being killed.
Oh, yeah, his reputation. When he came rolling into town, you basically had two things. You could either run and hide or you converted. Otherwise, you were dead.
Yeah. So, and, you know, after Khaybar, and he kept pushing after the capitulation of Mecca, he kept pushing, and he ended up conquering is the word, all of Arabia. He moved into Yemen, then east towards what are now the Arab Emirates, and then northern Arabia, and then he began penetrating the Byzantine Empire, which was the Christian Empire, and the southern part of it was controlled by Christianized Arabs. And Muhammad made one incursion there before dying. Excuse me, and then his followers took over from there. And very swiftly, they conquered what's now Syria and Iraq, moved into Persia, and they went west into what's now Egypt and Tunisia. So it was very swift, you know, like within 25 years, they'd conquered huge amounts of territory and imposed their religion and subjugated people. If they didn't want to convert, they had to pay a tax. But the slaughter was really great, really great, following Muhammad's. You know, the idea was plunder, booty. If you die fighting for the cause, you go to heaven, you get 72 virgins. That was the magic formula, you know.
Sure, you couldn't go wrong. You were either going to be rich on this world or rich in the next, either one, if you followed him.
Yeah, okay, listen, this is where I think it gets to be really important in terms of what to do about Islam. It's never going to change because it's all about Muhammad. So you either get rid of it or it will get rid of you, fundamentally. And it may take a long time for it to get rid of the United States and Western Europe, but the process is already underway. And if you don't get rid of it, it will get rid of you. But how do you get rid of something like Islam that's so seemingly entrenched? You know, it's important to know the life of Muhammad, but once you know it, what are you going to do with it? Are you just going to sit on it, chat over the fence with your neighbor about it? I suppose that's good, but this is actually what's in my book and which is derived from the original literature of Islam, is nuclear material. This is like plutonium that needs to be shaped into bombs and then exploded. I mean, that's how powerful all this stuff is for attacking and destroying Islam. This is so grotesque what he did to people who rejected him. He committed almost every crime that's considered a crime against humanity today. And I, in fact, included, I quoted in the chapter notes of my book, the section of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Tribunal, which defines what a crime against humanity is. And he committed just about every one of them. This is a tremendously powerful weapon that can be used against Muhammad if it's taken to a higher level than books. You know, my book is okay. It's got a lot of illustrations, but books are trickle down. Not that many people read books. But everybody watches movies.
Yeah.
Everybody watches movies. So this, if people really want to defend themselves against Islam, this is the weapon to use. The truth about Muhammad. Putting it on the big screen. Just imagine, you know, the kick in the gut that would come from people sitting there in a movie theater watching Muhammad, you know, behead all those men and boys, in the storytelling of a movie, you would get the whole context of it. And you would know some of these characters. And so there you would be with them when they're brought out to the trench and beheaded.
But what's the, Frank, what's the chances of anything like that ever happening when here we bought into the story that, you know, Benghazi was caused by a little homemade film? I mean, if a major movie company wanted to do the true life of Muhammad, my gosh.
We were talking
the
about
blowback
that, though,
from that would be...
That'd be huge.
Oh, it'd be unbelievable.
Yeah, it would. And all I can say about that is time to move beyond the fear that terror causes.
Right.
You know, and it's hard to do. I can't claim to be a total, you know, courageous person in this. But at least I've taken a step, which I think is useful, by writing this book.
Yeah, the research is done.
Yeah, there it all is, you know. Go for it, you know.
We were
somebody
talking,
with $100 million. You know,
well, we were chatting last week after the program about, you know, the fact that they do this in cartoon or in, what do I want to say, animation.
Animation, right. It's starting at that level, and that gets distributed on the Internet, and it's good. I mean, it's a beginning. But it's not sufficient.
No.
It has to go global.
It needs to be like a Lawrence of Arabia type of...
Yeah,
yeah,
big
and not
epic.
Only just one movie. One movie would be great. But what I say to people when I bend their ears about this is that if we were to take the what it costs to build a battleship, say $3 billion, and spread that over 10 years and put that money into productions of full-length Hollywood-quality feature films, hundreds of docudramas where there are reenactments to break the subject down into its parts, and put that out there globally for global consumption over the course of 10 years in aggressive, relentless, and unapologetic exposure of the truth about Muhammad that way, globally, Islam would be on the ropes within a generation. It would be absolutely on the ropes because there are two
you can't
audiences
defend it.
For this. There's the non-Muslim audience. People are waking up, but still most people don't have any clue about any of this. This is a good way to wake them up. Everybody watches movies, particularly when they're controversial. Then the other audience is the Muslim audience. This is what is really amazing. Most Muslims don't know the truth about Muhammad either. They are raised with the mythologized version, and they never read the traditions or the original source material. They just buy into it because they're raised into it, and so they believe it because that's what they're told is the truth. This is a way to bust through that, and it would push all Muslims onto the ropes. They would have to justify how they could have a belief in a guy like that.
Yeah, that's the thing. When you have to defend the person you're following, oops, especially when all of the traditions and things are about him. We need to take one more really quick break, and then we'll be right back with our guest, Frank Burley, who is the author of It's All About Muhammad. It's a biography of the world's most notorious prophet, and I think you'll like it. You can find all that information on our site. It's wethepeopleradio.us.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time. The more you ignore me, the closer I get. You're wasting your time.
Crazy, but that's how it goes.
So just in case you guys thought that we were going to drop the topic and move on, we're not. and I'm sure we'll have to have Frank on again, too. I just wanted to let folks know, because we always seem to run out of time at the end, that next week, basically the topic is, are Americans ready for the Islamists? With Lyle Rapacki with the Sentinel Intelligence Services and Claire Lopez, who is with the Center for Security Policy, and she is also former CIA. I got for training purposes only, simulated communication from Sentinel that said, started with, "Good evening, Americans. I'm from the Islamic State, and I'm here to annihilate your children. Well, you have preoccupied yourself with messaging your Facebook friends from the student pickup area at your local religious school. I've been surveilling my target." And it goes downhill from there.
Oh, yeah. It's frightening.
So we thought that would be a good follow-up to Frank's information, just in case you weren't sure if it was actually time for you to do something about this. So, Frank, in our waning minutes here, what would you like to leave folks with? I know there's just a ton of detail that you could never fit in.
Right. Read the book.
Yeah.
Read the book.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry.
It's really important to get familiar with the ins and outs of the subject, but then to do something with it. You know, give lectures, whatever. There's all kinds of things that could be done with it. But movies, that's a real way to go. That's the best defensive and offensive weapon there is against Islam.
You're right.
Turning all of this truth about Muhammad into film. In the end of my book, in the epilogue, I suggest a movie where he's put on trial for crimes against humanity. You know, like they did with Saddam Hussein, they had him in the docket there with his cronies in the background?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, then this is something that could be done, too, with Muhammad. In the background, you've got his cronies. You've got, Ali, you know, the mass murderer. Zubair is another first cousin who's a mass murderer. And then Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and all these people that became caliphs, you know. Put them on trial and then resurrect. This is the real day of the resurrection. It's not, you know, going before God and having Muhammad intercede on your behalf. No, resurrect the bodies, resurrect his victims from their graves. Bring them out of their graves and let them testify against Muhammad, what he did to them. And that could be, you know, the launching point for, you know, recreating what he did. You know, as they're talking, suddenly there it is on the screen, you know. So put them on trial. And humanity is the jury. Humanity will watch this. Men and women everywhere, young and old, of all races, will be the jurors. And it will end on that note. You are the jury. You make a decision about this. That's what needs to be done. That's just one way of approaching the subject. There's a lot of ways of doing a movie about that guy, but I think that's a real potent idea. If I had the money, I would do it. Anybody out there listening who's got $100 million?
Yeah, guaranteed to double your money.
Guaranteed you get to make the film in hiding. Yeah. If you need a little break from your friends and family.
Well, anyway, it's got to be done. And this is the best weapon. Islam is a danger, an existential danger, as George Bush used to say all the time. It's true. So what are you going to do? Get consumed by it, or are you going to fight it and get rid of it? You know, it's a real choice. Which way do you want it?
And I think we need to really pound the point that we're never going to coexist. It just doesn't mix with pretty much any other society, unless you want to be subservient, to their rules, and because there's no other way. I mean, if they're true believers, you can't coexist. It's ridiculous.
No, it's impossible. But you've got a lot of them embedded in our society now that push this notion, and Obama is one of them, that it's a religion of peace, et cetera, et cetera, and it's all baloney. It's a religion of war and domination and supremacy. And it's that way because it's all about Muhammad. And it will never be any different.
Sure.
And people who say things like that, they're total liars or they're ignoramuses, and they should be exposed, and we should Alinsky all of them, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's like I think you mentioned in your book that in today's world, a moderate Muslim would be executed by fundamentalists. I mean, they don't believe in moderation. They believe in the word of the Quran and the word of Muhammad, and there's nowhere in there that's moderate.
Yeah, well, and moderation, too. What does that mean? That's more like the quiet demographic, slow process of Islamization. That's what the moderate favors. And so, you know, moderates, there's no such a thing as moderate Islam. I mean, the president of Turkey says that all the time. it's a ruse. You know, it's just another way of pulling the wool over people's eyes. There are no innocent Muslims. Anybody who believes that God talked to Muhammad and dictated the contents of the Quran to him, and that they should follow his example in all things, that's what it is to be a Muslim. And they all believe that. So there are no innocent Muslims.
No.
There are no innocent Muslims.
It's dangerous.
That should be axiomatic.
Well, I think that's a very unpopular position. However, it's very true. So like many true things, dare to be unpopular. But definitely I would encourage people to get the book and read it. Because, you know, it's funny, I think I said this last week at the beginning of the program, got into a thing with a guy who was supposedly an expert on this, and he was figuratively disemboweled within about a minute and a half.
Yeah, he had no information.
I went full Muhammad on him.
Well, Frank, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing with us.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. Really great of you folks to hosts a program like this who would cover the subject. It's great.
See, and you thought you couldn't do 2 hours. And look, we just did four, and there's like, I don't know, a million hours left. All right, Frank, we will chat with you again.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks a million. We were just, we just completed the second program with Frank Burley, the author of It's All About Muhammad. Please go to the website, send your friends and family links. Robert will have those commercial-free things posted this afternoon. And see you next week, where we're going to talk some more about what it looks like on the ground. This is We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.